May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Welcome to another Cuke Audio Podcast. I'm DC Pooba of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, preserving the legacy of Shinryu Suzuki and those whose paths crossed his, and anything else that comes to mind. I pray that you and yours are safe and comfortable, free from economic hardship, and able to get out and do whatever it is you want within the limitations of the universal precept of do as little harm as possible. So we're going to have a guest now, Lou Richmond, and we've had him as a guest before. Lou and I were ordained together as priest by Shinryu Suzuki in 1971, shortly before he died. And Lou started the Vimala Sangha in Mill Valley, and he's written a number of books, and he blogs, and he's very active. And but you'll hear all about that. You can learn about Lou at lewisrichmond.com. And he writes for the, I think, weekly for the Good Man Project. It's Good Man or Good Men. Goodmanproject.com, I believe it is. Anyway, let's just give Lou a call, and we'll see what he has to say. So we'll do that right after the pause to meditate. So when you hear the bell, if you're of such a mind, hit pause and meditate or whatever for as long as you wish. And when you're through, hit unpause. And we'll hit the bell to end the meditation, and we'll get hold of Lou. Hi, Lou.
Hey.
How you doing?
Good. I was just reading up on Bali on Wikipedia to try to get a little more familiar with where you live. It's an amazing country.
Yeah. It's a nice place to live, nice people. And that's not just the Balinese. That's Indonesians in general. Very polite and easygoing, but Bali especially, it's really nice. So, what are you up to these days?
Well, we should start by saying I just had my 75th birthday.
Oh, a youngster!
Yeah, last week. And I just wrote a blog post about being 75 and kind of my thoughts about it. You know, I know you're a little older than me. I don't feel old particularly, although 75 sounds old, you know, in my ear. 75
right.
Sounds old.
Right.
But I don't feel any older than I felt, I don't know, 10 years ago. I mean, mentally I'm the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to rest more, I have to take naps, you know, the usual drill.
Yeah.
But I'm in good health, and Amy's in good health, and you know, I'm living a quiet life up here in the town of Sonoma, surrounded by vineyards.
Right.
Really is wine country. I mean, it's a funny mix of, it's very touristy, as you know, you've been here. But it's also very agricultural. It's like living in farm country.
Right.
And there are lots of skilled vineyard workers, many of whom I think come up from Mexico for the season, who are very well trained in how to do everything. It's very, very complex to grow grapes. And we're far enough south and surrounded by vineyards so that the fires, which are going to come, there's just no question about it. California's dry as a bone. They're probably not going to come quite as far down as we are, but they say now that we're living in a 1,000-year drought up here in Northern California.
Is that right?
Really, wow. The whole West. And it's when you step back and look at the photographs of Lake Mead and the reservoirs, they're just practically gone. You realize the world is the natural world that we grew up with and that we took for granted is in very, very sorry shape, very, very dire.
Yep.
Very dire. And, but life is very quiet. And I'm living the life of a retired, very retired Zen person and writer. I've fashioned myself like the Zen teachers of old, who at a certain point in their life just walked away from everything and found a quiet, remote place to live where nobody really knew they were there. and that's kind of a tradition in our tradition. You read about these people. Joshu, who was probably the most famous Chinese Zen master, you know, had a huge, huge monastery. The walls were a mile square, and it's still there. Ed Sadazan visited. They've restored it.
Oh.
And his stone bridge that he writes about in the koans is still there. But now he's lived to be an old age in the monastery, but a lot of these very well-known teachers turned it over to a disciple and then just walked away. And I sort of feel that's age appropriate.
Yeah.
It also fits kind of where my life is at. I'm concentrating on writing. I write a weekly blog, which posts up on this very large website called The Good Men Project, as you know. But
right.
I've also been reposting it. The best place to find it is on my own website, lewisrichmond.com. And
yes.
All my blog posts are there.
Good. Better place to read them.
Yeah, and I've become a very competent blogger. I've learned to collect my thoughts every week and write about 750 words on some topic. And it's different than writing a book, which you've done and I've done, and it's different than writing a magazine article. It's its own thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm. What was the most recent thing you wrote about?
Well, I just today wrote about being 75, but last week I wrote a very heartfelt post about the war in Ukraine, or just war. War is back, war never left. And I reminisced because now the threat of nuclear is a little bit back. Maybe it's bluffing, maybe it's not, but we're certainly aware that we're in deep conflict with a country like us that has 6,000 nuclear weapons. And I thought back, I wrote about being a kid. I'm sure you remember this too. In the 50s, we had drills where, you know, bomb drills where we crawled under our desks and put our head down as though somehow that was going to protect us from an atom bomb. You know, it was silly,
right.
But it was something to do. And I remember the fear, the naked fear that we all felt. It was very, very possible. And I don't know how it was down your way in Texas, but in California, people built bomb shelters. That was a big thing to do.
Yeah, there was a bomb shelter a block from where I lived as a teenager. Right.
Yeah, and my dad couldn't afford a bomb shelter. So what he did, he wanted to protect his family. So we had a garage with an earth floor, and he dug out a pit about 3-4 feet deep under that and put boards down so that under the car was a kind of makeshift shelter. And I remember him working weekends, you know, just all by himself. He dug it out. That was the level of fear. And the deja vu is tremendous to remember. We kind of forgot. I mean, the high point of my anti-nuclear war activities was, you know, I went to the Nuclear Freeze March in New York City in 1983. And that was just to get the weapons frozen was kind of a big campaign worldwide, you may remember.
Oh, yeah. I worked for the Nuclear Freeze.
Yeah. And we marched. It was an amazing event, actually, because I went with Dick Baker, and we joined up with Thich Nhat Hanh and Brother David and some other luminaries. And we were in the front row of the march. There were a million people behind us on Fifth Avenue.
And oh, goodness.
They'd been planning this march for years. They had it all worked out with the police, the fire, the unions, everything. And we locked arms. Fifth Avenue is not very wide. So we locked arms. And then Thich Nhat Hanh started to walk very, very slowly, the way he always did, you know?
Yeah. How did that work out?
He made the entire million people, Americans, walk at his pace.
Oh, God.
It was unbelievable. The march organizers absolutely panicked because they had this all worked out to the minute. They didn't know what to do, but you know, I knew Thich Nhat Hanh well enough to know that this was his moment to say something to the world and to America.
Yeah.
And by walking slowly, he understood. I think he probably just spontaneously realized that he could do this. We were not about to walk faster than Thich Nhat Hanh. He was the saint in the row.
Yeah.
Eventually, the march organizers figured out they had to get the march to go around us. So they directed people to go around the sidewalk. And by the time the march ended, we were not in the front of the march. We were in the back of the march.
Oh, that is really interesting. Wow.
That wasn't widely reported. And, you know, a couple of tricycle issues ago when they published my Suzuki Roshi article, Food is Very Important, totally by coincidence, there was a photograph of that march, because I think there was an article about Thich Nhat Hanh in there, showing me and Thich Nhat Hanh and Dick Baker with arms locked that moment. Well, I have the What is War articles coming out in May. They're publishing my blog post about what is war with Suzuki Roshi. You know that story very well.
Yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
They moved it up. They're publishing it. My guess is the May issue is going to be about war. And so I've been, even though I'm essentially on retirement and retreat, I am having some impact.
Mm.
And they tell me at Tricycle that my first article about Suzuki Roshi was extremely popular. So it's being well read by a new generation of people who didn't know him.
Mm. That's great. That's great.
But I look back at the nuclear freeze and I think, boy, that sure seems innocent and naive compared to the world we're in today.
Yeah. 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 That people don't realize, they think that was taken care of back then. They don't realize that the threat of nuclear war, mainly accidental nuclear war, you know, has not really decreased at all. It's an ever-present threat.
It's ever-present. And
even
though we did reduce, Russia and the U.S. did reduce the number of weapons a lot, it's unbelievable how many there were, there's still around, if you put all the nuclear powers together, around 15,000 nukes on planet Earth. Sufficient, yeah. I think, to destroy the entire biosphere if they all went off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I have, I've never stopped, you know, keeping up with that. And that's definitely true. There have been, that actually, people who follow it say we've gotten closer to nuclear war since the wall came down than beforehand. And mainly through accidents.
Yeah, I think back in the old days, there was a kind of grim rationality on both sides. Both sides understood that there would be no winner to such a war, and everybody was coldly rational. Now, I don't think cold rationality is how I would describe the current state of affairs.
Right, 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 right. That's true, very true. I'm going to ask you, you're not writing any book. You're not planning on doing another book?
Not at the moment. I'm just putting one foot in front of the other. And I'm writing about various topics. My recollections of Suzuki Roshi are one of those topics. But I'm writing about aging, which is my specialty.
Right.
And I'm writing about current affairs, which, you know, we're all writing about. And also, you know, my audience on Good Men Project is primarily a younger audience. It's basically turned into a kind of progressive website. With, you know, they have forums on climate change and dating and LGBT and feminism and, you know, progressive topics. Think
yeah.
of it as like The Guardian or something.
Yeah.
And so I feel like as an older guy, an older man, I they'll let me write whatever I want. They're very appreciative. But I'm trying to write, keeping in mind that the biggest age cohort is 25 to 35. And actually, in spite of its title, more women than men.
Huh. I'm surprised. I didn't realize.
Well, women, I think women tune into the site to find out try to figure men out.
Uh-huh.
So I do feel that as a kind of elder, in my mind, I have an invisible audience of a younger generation that I'm trying to speak to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. That's really good, because that is, that's one of the most important things right now, is how to connect the older generation and the younger generation. And so much of what is happening is the older generation talking to the older generation. So that, I'm really glad to hear you say that. Yeah.
Well, you and I had a model. We were young people going to Suzuki Roshi's temple, and he was a man in his early 60s. And he was extraordinarily kind and respectful to us kids. You know, we were what? In our early 20s, right?
Right.
And he came to America, and most of the people that came to his temple were very young.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he ever once talked down to us or looked down at us or said, "You're just kids, you don't know anything." I mean, he treated us with great respect. And that's something, it's not often remarked about him that was one of his qualities, but it was. He was.
Oh, I remark on it. I remark on it because people tell me, you know, people say over and over that he understood them in a way that nobody else understood them, and they never felt, you know, but people will say very extreme things like the only person who ever really understood them, or the only person who ever really listened to them or respected them.
It might not be reported on very widely, but that's overwhelmingly what I hear and have received about him and continue to.
Well, I mean, he was that way because he was an extraordinarily perceptive and intuitive person. And you felt that the minute he looked at you. But I think in addition to that, he never made any distinction between young or old. You could be 22, and as far as he was concerned, he would take you as seriously as an 80-year-old Roshi from Japan.
Yeah, that's true.
And there aren't that many people that are like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were, what was unusual, kind of unique, it only happens once every few hundred years, we were a generation of youthful seekers. That doesn't happen very often, that the very young suddenly open up to spiritual possibility.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. There certainly was a lot of that. Yeah.
And, you know, I was a student of Erik Erikson, the great psychoanalyst. I actually did literally study with him in college. And
where?
At Harvard.
Right.
He had a class for seniors. I forget what it was called, but it was kind of to get us set to go out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
It was the most popular class at Harvard. There were like 1,000 people. The entire senior class went.
Wow.
He also came to all the sections and met with, you know, 15 or 20 people at a time. He was a wonderful man. And he, one of his great books was called Young Man Luther. He was fascinated with the fact that usually people seek the spiritual in their mature years, but that Luther had what he called a premature integrity crisis. In other words, at a very early age, his mind opened up to ultimate questions.
Hmm. So that's what so many of us had.
That's right. A whole generation of us, it opened up for us. Partly it was psychedelics, but I don't think that was the whole story.
I was that way before psychedelics.
I was too. I mean, psychedelics were never a key driver of my interest in Buddhism. I was interested in Buddhism when I was 15.
Hmm, that's pretty good. Hmm. Yeah, I look back on it sometimes, sort of like you're talking about now, as if it were a social force. I mean, I look back and I say, why did I have certain ideas? Why did I feel that way? Why did my friends and me in Texas all believe in integration? You know, what made us do that? You know, and why did so many people become seekers and reject the paradigm they were given? It's like I feel like it's something more than just coming out of me, you know. It was like a wave.
Yeah, it's you can theorize about it that it we were the generation, the baby boomers that were born out of the ashes of World War II. Our parents were traumatized by the Depression and the war, and they were determined to build a utopian, peaceful life for their kids, who were us.
Huh.
And we lived a kind of protected life, an idealized life.
Boy, yeah.
When we came of age and actually saw how the world really was, it opened up, as you say, a huge tidal wave, a social force of change.
Mm.
And now, in our 70s, we're our life as that generation is coming to its conclusion, and each person who was a part of that, whether it was civil rights or protesting against the war or feminism or social change in the communities of color, whatever it was, we're all looking back now and saying, wow, that was something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how it happened, but I got caught up in that, and that was really something.
Yeah.
And that's part of what I'm trying to convey to my younger audience, that they don't know about that world. To them, Vietnam is like in the haze of prehistory.
Right.
They don't know about that.
Right. Oh. Yeah. Would you list your books, like, from the first?
My first book published in 98 was called Work as a Spiritual Practice. And
yep.
It came out of my going out from living at Zen Center to working in the corporate world. And my second book was written after I nearly died from a brain infection. And it's really a memoir about that recovery. It's called Healing Lazarus. I was Lazarus, essentially raised from the dead.
Yeah, really.
And my third book, which is very little known, is called A Whole Life's Work. A Whole Life's Work, which was really an effort. Other people have done a better job of this, to apply the six paramitas of the Bodhisattva's life to modern life.
Mm.
Which is, you know, a Bodhisattva's life is a whole life's work. That's the meaning of the title.
Hey, can you list the six paramitas? Can you remember them now?
Well, let's see. You're challenging me on this. giving, precepts, energy, virya, I forget the fourth one. The fifth one is meditation, and the sixth one is wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
I'm missing one, but.
Mm-hmm. Right, let me see. Six paramitas. All right. Oh my God. Then, no, hell, in the Pali Canon, they've got like 10. Hell. Here's the six. Dana, generosity. Sila, virtue.
Yeah.
Kasanti, patience.
That's the one I missed.
Yeah. Virya, energy. Jhana, one pointed, you know, I'm just reading what it says in Wikipedia here. One pointed concentration, contemplation. Prajna, paramita, wisdom, insight.
Well, just to finish before we leave the topic, you asked me to list my books. The fourth
book.
Yeah,
keep going.
Aging as a Spiritual Practice, which I wrote 8 years ago, and that was really a kind of applying Buddhist teachings and Buddhist wisdom to the aging experience.
Yeah.
And see aging itself as a spiritual journey. And my most recent book, which came out 18 months ago, is called Every Breath, New Chances.
Right.
How to age with honor and dignity.
Hmm. Hmm. Wow, pretty good. And you've written lots of articles and blogs. Is it all on your website, either listed where someone can get it, or the actual, like, are all your articles and blogs on your website?
Well, LouRichmond.com,
right? LouRichmond.com.
LouRichmond.com.
LouRichmond.
All the books are there. All the books are there. You can click on the books and buy them. I've only really been blogging consistently for about 10 months, so it's not like I have years and years of blogging.
Well, you don't need it. 10 months is good.
Well, I'm going to keep at it.
Yeah.
And, of course, I also have a music life, too, which we I don't want to get off on that too much. But
oh, but I do on, I do want you to talk about that.
Well, that's on my website, too. And there's a separate website you can go to. Melanthium.com, which is my music group. That's M as in Mary, E-L-A, N as in Nancy, T-H-I-U-M as in Mary, Melanthium.
Please define.
Melanthium?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, I know what it is, but I can't remember it right now. Let me see.
Well, look, it's
remind
it's
me. Not,
it, the only thing that reason we picked it, there's two reasons we picked it. The main reason, you know, as you know, it's very hard to find a name for a musical group. So we kept noodling around until we found that one. And that we Googled it, and it's not a music group. So we picked it.
Right.
It actually is the name of a beautiful little flower that grows in Virginia.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's a wonderful name.
But also, it's kind of a evokes anthem. There's musical words, melody, anthem.
Yeah, Melanthium. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very melodic name. Yeah.
Yeah.
Melodic. And, it's melodic and has melody in the name. And
it's
anthem,
a group
right.
of five musicians, four professionals and me, and all the music is written by me. And we were performing and doing things. There's a few tracks on YouTube. If you're persistent, you can find us. But like every other music scene, COVID pretty much dried us up. I mean, we couldn't perform and it was difficult to rehearse. So we're just now thinking about how we're going to proceed and do we want to get back together and all that. COVID was terrible for musicians, just terrible.
You know, I started a music group here during COVID because there's so many out of work musicians I knew, and we practice quite a bit because we can practice outside. It's always good weather here.
Oh, I see.
And, yeah, we're called Bali Yuga.
Oh, that's
we
great.
We don't perform, just record.
Yeah, well, that may be how we're going to go. We can record and put our stuff up on YouTube. And
yeah,
it's one of the projects I'm thinking about. But, you know, when you're 75, your mind can still think of many, many things to do, just like when you're 35, but the body doesn't necessarily have the same energy to execute those things.
Yeah.
So yeah. It may take some time, but I'm impressed that you're able to put something together like that.
Yeah. Oh, it's people here are so nice to work with, and it's all my music. Just like, you know, when you said that, I thought, yeah, same thing I do. You and I have a lot in common, although we're very different people. But I've listened to all your stuff. I like it. I've got it all.
Well, that's great, David. I appreciate that. And I would say that if I had to pick one word about where my head is at, to use an old expression from the 60s, I'm becoming more reflective about everything.
Yeah. I want to say one other thing about music. is that I'm a hack musician. You are a real musician. You could have been a concert pianist, I think.
Yeah, I could have.
Yeah. Anyway, I wanted to make that clear.
Well, in this blog I wrote about reminiscence and being 75, I quoted Bob Dylan. You may know this lyric. Senor, senor, can you tell us where we're heading? Lincoln County Road or Armageddon?
Yeah.
You know that song?
I mean, that rings a bell, definitely. I haven't listened to it recently.
Not one of his more well-known songs, but I think it's a wonderful lyric for where we are right now. Lincoln County Road is like ordinary life. It's like, you know, driving to the grocery store.
Yeah.
Or Armageddon.
Yeah.
Dylan was a master of juxtaposing the ordinary with the utterly extraordinary.
Ah, well said. Yeah.
And there's so many songs that are like that. And that popped into my mind because Armageddon's back on the map.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Well, it's pretty self-explanatory, but I'll tell you a story, and you can probably tell me a story because we all have these stories now. And I think when you're older, you start to see your life that way. But when I was a graduate student in Berkeley, I was driving down the street in my VW Bug, and I stopped at a stop sign and moved into the intersection. And then from the right, like a bat out of hell, was a guy on a motorcycle. Speeded through the intersection. His kickstand just clicked against my front bumper. No, click.
Ooh.
And he wobbled a little bit, stayed up, and gunned his bike and was gone.
Mm.
And if he'd been an inch closer, he might have been dead.
Oh, would that bring up one thing? No, it brings up many things. My son Clay, you know, my younger son, last year he was moving stuff into his yurt where he lives, where he's moving out of into a nice big house. And he fell asleep and he ran into the end of a fence and a 2x4. It was actually more like a thick, maybe 3x4. Came right through the windshield and grazed the side of his head, went bang right back into the car. And the cops and the ambulance people who came, he was all right, you know. I had just been talking to him, and then he sends me these pictures with blood all over him. And he says, I'm all right. And they said, do you believe in angels? You know.
Well, yeah. Ivan was in an accident like that. He was driving home from Portland. And a friend of his was driving the car, and he fell asleep. They were on the freeway. The driver fell asleep, and the car veered to the right, not to the left into all the other traffic, but veered to the right, rolled over, and came to rest on a grassy embankment.
Wow.
Nobody was hurt. Ivan called me, just like Clay called you, and said, hey, Dad, don't want you to worry, but I just want you to know I've been in an accident. And I didn't tell him what I thought, but what I thought was, veer to the right, you're okay. Veer to the left, you're dead. You know, the 3x4 goes 1 inch to the left, and Clay is no more.
Right. Right. Well, a lot of things. I'm not going to mention anything else.
I think that all of us who are older, one way to frame the life that we have lived is in terms of those events really stick in your mind, those close calls. They're really kind of markers in your life. And part of the reason you're here and I'm here is because we got lucky.
Yeah.
A few times, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. You not only had your viral encephalitis, is that what you had?
Yeah.
You had very serious cancer.
I did when I was 35. And I think that if you stop anybody and say, close your eyes and stop and think, tell me about the close calls in your life. They're there. They're in your memory. And another line from Dylan that I quote in that context is, I can't help it if I'm lucky.
Yeah.
I can't help it if I'm lucky. That's part of a longer song I won't go into, but, you know, when you actually parse that line, it's a rather deep sort of line. It's sort of slightly sardonic or cynical or something. I can't help it of course you can't help it. If you're lucky, you're lucky, you're lucky. But, I think that part of why you get to the stage of old age where you can reflect on a life lived is because we've all been lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. I tend not to look at things as a series of random events, though. you know what I mean? I mean, to me, lucky is, it's not comprehensible, but, you know, it's good karma. But I don't think karma is comprehensible. Anybody tries to explain it, it's, anyway, I wanted to ask you something about your dog. When you had that cancer, and I think I mentioned this in our last podcast, which a year and a half ago or something, your dog, which normally didn't hang out with you when you were in bed, stayed with you, got the type of cancer you had and died, and yours went away, yours was like super serious, just like your viral encephalitis was. Like, you were viral encephalitis, I was at Green Gulch, and we were waiting for you to die. You didn't have a gag reflex anymore. So you got very close.
That's right. Well, the dog story's more interesting than that. The dog, when I got better from my cancer, the dog got sick. And I took the dog to the vet. And the vet examined him and he said, you know, I need to take some x-rays. You come back in a week. I came back in a week and the doctor put up the x-rays and said, your dog has a big tumor in his abdomen. I looked at the x-ray and I saw where the tumor was. And I pulled up my shirt and said to the vet, that's the same place I had my tumor. I've got a big 10-inch vertical scar right on my belly.
Yeah.
And I said, that's exactly where I had my tumor. I had cancer. And I could tell from the vet's expression that this is way beyond him. This was, this was above his pay grade, as they say.
Yeah.
But there apparently are legends. I haven't been able to track them down, but there are legends in the Native American world that certain dogs, medicine dogs, have that power.
Yeah.
Draw your illness away from you.
Well, I was just here. We practice music on the bale, which is like a stage with a roof and just columns, you know? And yeah. My dog was licking my knee where I had a sore. And Goose, spelled G-U-S, the lead guitarist, said, oh, dogs are good for your health. You know, he's paying attention to that there. Dogs are healers. So, I mean, that's not just American Indians.
Well, I love that dog. I have a picture of him. I'm looking at him right now. He was an extraordinary being. And, you know, I've been lucky a lot. And now that I'm living in my dacha in the wine country, I'm having a chance to realize how lucky I've been.
Yeah.
I was lucky to meet my wife. I've been married to her for 54 years.
Wow.
I met her in high school, you know.
My.
How often does that happen, you know?
Wow, yeah.
And and when you feel that you've been lucky, like I feel, and you realize that, yeah, I'm okay, 75, I'm doing well, but I'm not going to live forever. Maybe I've got, if I'm lucky, 10 more good years. What do I want to do with that 10 more years? Well, one of the things I want to do, and in this case, you and I are very aligned, I want to let a new generation of Americans and then elsewhere in the world, I want them to know more about Suzuki Roshi.
Mm.
The archive of his lectures that have been recorded, that's one thing. But the spontaneous stories, the things, the way he was, the things he did when he met you, when he looked at you, all the things that you've collected, you've already done a lot of this work, and I want to join in with it in some way.
Oh, yeah, please do. Yeah.
Yeah, and let people understand this really was, we're not fooling around, this was a genuinely extraordinary person.
Yeah. Yeah.
The kind that don't come along maybe once every few hundred years.
Mm. Mm.
And
yet people would say over and over, people would say, but he was so ordinary.
Well, he was ordinary because he was truly humble.
Yeah.
You remember at one point, Dick wanted to get him on the cover of Time magazine.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Well, guess what Suzuki Roshi said to that idea?
What?
But he wasn't in the slightest bit interested in something like that.
Oh, yeah, of course not. I'm surprised Dick would do that because he was rather cautious about publicity.
Well, it could be apocryphal. It could be false. But, you know, the first time I met Suzuki Roshi, it was at Mel Weitzman's house in Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
And there were about six of us for Zazen. And I was already facing the wall, and I heard the rustle of robes behind me, and then somebody sat down behind me, maybe 4 to 6 feet away, so close that I could hear him breathe. It didn't matter to him whether it was one person or 100 or whatever. And afterwards, sometimes he'd stay for breakfast. Again, 5 or 6 people. Yes, he was ordinary, but he was ordinary in an extraordinary way.
I have something I must ask you. Can't remember who told me this. It was in a podcast. Somebody, and it's Berkeley, somebody sitting at Berkeley, somebody who met you and knew you what and you first came, and they told me, I really can't believe it. They said your dog, I think it was you, followed you from Oregon or something. Do you know, was that you?
Well, that's almost right. He didn't follow me from Oregon. We had a beautiful Samoyed that was given to us in Oregon. And when we drove back in a GMC pickup, he rode in the back. He came with us, that's all.
You know, that person thought that your dog was left in Oregon and came all the way to San Francisco and found you. And I found that very hard to believe.
Well, that's a nice story.
Good story.
Dogs do. I wrote another blog post about a dog quite recently I saw on NPR. This is a real story. these people had an accident on a country road, and the dog jumped out of the car and ran away, and they couldn't find him. The driver was injured, and it took them a while to get together. And then they tried to find the dog, and they talked to the neighbors. These were farm people with farms, and the people in the area were really nice. They said, "Well, here's what we'll do: we'll set up a remote camera to take pictures, and we'll do it right where the accident was, because sometimes dogs come back." You know, to the last place they saw their family.
That's right.
And sure enough, they began to get snapshots of the dog twice a day. He would come out of the woods and he would check out that spot, and then he would go away.
Mm.
And they tried to capture him. They couldn't. And finally, he emerged. He was very thin, but the family found him, and there was this wonderful picture of him licking his owner's face. So dogs, that's a real story.
Yeah.
not a made up story about a dog that was loyal. And I'm sure you know the great story about the loyal dog at the Japanese train station.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's very famous.
Oh yeah. I can almost remember the name. Yeah. We were in Mexico in Baja California, Todos Santos, and Clay was camping down at the beach there, and we were at the beach at night, and there were fireworks going off, and Katrinka's dog, terrified of fireworks, ran off into the brush, and we couldn't find her. Lady Jane. We looked for her the next day and everything. And I ran into an old guy, like later on the next day, we'd given up. And he was on a bicycle riding on this little dirt path we were. And I asked him about the dog. He said, "Oh, just go back where you saw him last. He'll come back there." And so Clay stayed at the beach, and she did after 3 days.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Mm.
Well, I think that we're probably getting close to winding up for tonight, but my comment on all of that is, and it connects back to Suzuki Roshi, is there is genuine magic in the world. There really is.
Yeah, there you go.
And you and I have both been touched by it in various ways. And I think the best thing we can do as we grow older is just to do what we can. I mean, you have an audience. I have an audience. I reach people to remind people and convince them that the magic is not dead. It's still there. Sometimes it's very hard to find. And if you read the news too much, or if you get sucked into social media or what seems to be happening, you'll lose the magic. The magic is a much softer voice.
Mm.
You have to go someplace where it's very quiet.
Mm. 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 Well said. Well, Kanzai, you know, the great Buddhist scholar focusing on the Prajnaparamita when we were young, he said, "There's no Buddhism without magic." Or something like that in a class I was in with him. Yeah.
Yeah, he did. He was kind of an extraordinary person, strange person, and with shadows and demons. But
yeah,
he had an unbelievable understanding of language and the inner meaning of language. And I think we were one of the good things about our early years at the Zen Center was we were exposed to some of the top teachers and scholars in the world. I mean, we were there when Tom Cleary was first starting his career as a translator. And I don't know if you were in the class.
Oh yeah.
When we read the Zen Roku and the Chinese Tripitaka in classical Chinese, somehow or other, he got us to do that.
I wasn't in that class. I was in another.
Yeah, well, that's when I realized that, as you probably know, all the koans, all the Zen stories, the entire literature of Zen comes from the Roku, which are the biographical stories of each Chinese teacher. All the koans came from the Roku. And what I feel you have done with your website and with your books is you've created a Suzuki Roshi Roku. And that's a disciple's work. And without the Roku, we would know nothing about Joshu and Hyakujo and Six Patriarch and all of that. And the Roku are not lectures. The Roku are stories, just like you've published the stories. And the stories came not from the teacher, but from the recollection of the disciples. After the teacher died, they would all get together and they created those Roku. Now, I don't know about you, but the first inspiration I had about Zen was reading the stories in Paul Reps's books, you know, and thinking, wow, what is this? I've never seen or heard or read of anything like this. There's something going on here. I want to know about this.
Yeah. Yeah. Zen flesh, Zen bones. That's true. And you know, you know what you said about it wasn't, it's not the lectures, it's the Roku that wasn't compiled by the teachers. I think it was the Blue Cliff Records, which was it, that the teacher destroyed and threw away. The guy had to write it again, or some one of those great collections.
It was the Blue Cliff Records.
Yeah.
Well, when they compiled it out of the Roku into the Blue Cliff Record and started to use it to train people, that's when he decided to burn it. He didn't believe in koans as a teaching method. But before they were koans, they were stories from the Roku.
All of
them. And I learned that from Tom Cleary.
Yeah, he was something. And like you said about Kanze, Cleary had demons. Wow.
But he was, I mean, to watch him in action, to watch the sheer brilliance of his mind, his ability to translate. I mean, you and I are sitting here talking about Zen and talking about our life with Suzuki Roshi. Our entire life that we're talking about could never have happened if it weren't 1500 years ago, a bunch of Chinese monks for generations preserved and put together all these stories.
That's well said. We're
connected to them by karma and by affinity.
Right.
They're our brothers.
Right.
They're our brothers.
Well said. Well said. Good thing to keep in mind. So you think we ought to call it a day?
It's a day in your part of the world. It's night in my part of the world.
Right.
Let's see, 8 o'clock. Another hour, and I'm asleep, David. I don't know about you.
Oh, we've only been talking an hour. That's good. That's a nice length. It's 11 a.m. here, and it's 8 p.m. there.
It's tomorrow. It's already tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're like, what? I don't know. We're 3 hours, so 15 hours ahead of you. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I can assure you that tomorrow works out very well. It's an excellent day.
Well, as always, it's great talking to you.
And, yeah.
You know, I'm sure you know the Japanese word inen or gonen, which is often translated as affinity or karmic connection.
Uh-huh.
And I always felt from the very first day I came to Zen Center, and I'll tell you that story, that you and I have inen.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, go in. Yeah. Yeah.
Gonen. Gonen means honorable nen. When I came to Sokoji, I was very intimidated, very nervous. And I walked in and it was all silent and smelled strange and everything. And I was at the bottom of the stairs and the only person there was you. And you were at the top of the stairs. And you said, "Hey there, my name's David. What's your name?"
Huh.
And the minute you said that, I felt like I could stay.
That's interesting. Well, I'm glad I said it. Worked out pretty well.
You are. I mean, you were always that way. You were part of why I think Suzuki Roshi loved you and thought of you as so special, is because you were completely yourself. You never tried to be anybody. You never tried to be good. You just were you. And just like saying that, like, "Hi, I'm," you know, it wasn't Zen. It wasn't spiritual. It was just, "Hi, I'm David. What's your name?" It was just totally ordinary. And I've never forgotten that, because it was, you can say, well, it's just an accident. I happen to be there, blah, blah. But no, that was an instance of magic.
Hey, good Lord. I've never been told I was a magician before.
Well, I'm not saying it's you.
No. We were there. That's true. We were there in the midst of magic.
That's right. And I walked into that door and I needed somebody to greet me. And you were there and you greeted me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I stayed. So that was what? A long time ago, 55 years maybe, or 53 years.
When was that? 67?
Yeah, 67.
That's 55 years ago.
That's right. And so here we are. We're still talking. We're still cooking. We're still alive. And hopefully for quite a while longer. And let's do it again.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Well, thanks for doing all you do and staying in touch. And I like to stay in touch with what you're up to. And, let me tell you one thing. I'm going this evening or this afternoon late to Ubud, which is 30 minutes away, which is a trip for me. I mean, we just usually walk places in our neighborhood. And I'm taking our housekeeper, her 19-year-old daughter, and her 22-year-old daughter, and there's another 19-year-old that normally goes with me. We're going to a poetry slam in Ubud, so they can meet other young people who are like hip and interesting, and women poets, and, you know, guys too. It's not Zen, but it's nice to be around. There's middle-aged people, young people, occasional older person, but it's great to be around that scene there. And,
well, good.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm glad. I was very glad to hear when you said that the posts, or what do we call them, the articles you're writing for the Good Man blog, Good Man magazine. What's it called? Give me that.
Good Men Project.
Good Men Project, right.
Goodmenproject.com.
Goodmenproject.com. Yeah, I mean, I've got a link to it from your webpage, but the age of the people who are going there and reading you, the average is 25 to 35. That is great. That is great.
Yeah.
Good for you. I'm really happy about that. Yeah. Okay. Well, Lou, have a good evening, a good sleep, and we'll be in touch.
Okay, David. Take care.
Yeah. You too. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks a lot, Lou Richmond. Very good. Very good. Really good to talk to you. And hey, let's do it again in a year, huh? This has been a Cuke Audio podcast. I'm DC Pooba of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, coming to you from Sleepy Senor with Doggett Bandita, Feline Cuchita, and dear lovely Katrinka. And we're wishing you and yours and all of us a grand awakening.